Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Dan, and I'm joined today by the lovely Margarita.
Hello. Today we've got the transgender mind-body problem, an interview featuring Professor of Philosophy at the Open University, Sophie Grace Chappell. This took place in 2023 at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, the philosophy festival produced by the team here at the II. So Dan, tell us a bit about this interview.
Well, here Sophie Grace questions whether gender has an essentialist element, the potential virtues of living free of binaries, and how this all intersects with classical ideas of gender, feminism, and the subjective experience.
Amazing. Now remember, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to leave a review, subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Now it's time to welcome Sophie Grace Chappell to Philosophy for Our Times. We hope you enjoy listening.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
So you've worked on ethics, you've worked on ancient philosophy for much of your career. People often wonder, is there progress in philosophy in terms of the answers we give to questions? But what would you say about the questions themselves? Is there any progress in terms of the questions that ethics asks, or are we asking the same questions that Plato and Aristotle did?
I think we are always asking the same questions, but that doesn't mean there isn't progress. There are different ways in which you might distinguish progress. There's political progress, which of course matters enormously, because where there's political progress, then people get to live lives that they're happy with and lives where they can use their talents and lives where they can be fulfilled. So political progress is one thing that ethical progress can lead to. There's also a sense in which the progress in ethics is progress in self-understanding. And that, of course, is a problem that we all face. And we start on the journey of self-understanding, or not, early on in our own lives. And to make progress for us, I think, is for us to come to a better appreciation of what's important, what really matters, what's worth pursuing, and what isn't so much. And that kind of progress is, well, tragically, it's reversed all the time, because each of us has one life to live and we all die. So I think one of the reasons why people worry that there's no progress in ethics is precisely because of the simple fact of human mortality. And I think it's also undeniable that there is a kind of progress which consists in us learning, me learning, to understand things better and to be a better person. And that is also transmissible. You can teach that.
I'm aware that you're working on this issue of gender, and I was wondering, are questions around the nature and philosophy of gender new questions, questions that the ancients perhaps weren't even aware of? Or do you think it's a variation of a question that we were already asking thousands of years ago?
I think it's the latter. I think gender is a very interesting one because there has been so much change in the way society configures itself about gender, and there's enormous change happening right now in that area. And it is also a good example of the distinction I was just talking about between political progress, outer progress, social progress, and personal, spiritual progress in one's own understanding. So each of us has a journey to make in life, from being perhaps someone who lives in a fairly small world, has quite constrained horizons, and has a very simple sense of what's good and bad, and is perhaps, in the words of the U2 song, someone for whom, when I was three, I thought the world revolved around me, I was wrong. Maybe we do all start out with that kind of primitive selfishness and learn to overcome it. But of course, the two kinds of progress that we can have, the political progress towards a better understanding of how women, men, and others should relate to each other, that and the kind of personal progress that I'm talking about interact, because there are discoveries that people need to make in their own lives about how to treat each other. And because children, unfortunately, they're not born with the prejudices of their parents. They're born with a fairly innocent eye on the world, but also with a certain kind of selfishness self-centeredness. Children, as they get older, they pick up prejudices from their parents, and their parents indoctrinate them in a way of seeing things. And you come to think, for example, that it's okay to take the lead in everything because you're a boy, and it's okay to take a back seat and just do what you're told because you're a girl. And that kind of indoctrination is the very opposite of progress.
So our questions around gender identity, a variation of the Socratic question or imperative, know thyself.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a good way of putting it. You come to understand, if you're transgender as I am, you come to understand that there's a certain kind of mismatch in you between the way you are physically and the way you are in some senses socially too, and the way that you feel comfortable, the way that you want to be, the way that you feel truly represents who you are. And I mean, one can get enormously worked up about this and make out that it's the most important thing in the world. Of course it isn't. Of course it's not. For example, the climate crisis is much more important. But for the person who's struggling with their own self-understanding, with their own identity, it can become all-consuming. And it's very interesting. I mean, just from my own experience, I know that once I got this sorted out, once I began to live in the gender presentation that I'm happier in, once I began to think of myself in that way and live in that way, things just became enormously easier. And the whole problem kind of receded. It receded into the background. Having sorted that out, I was able to move on and get on with other things. And that, I think, is one of the best reasons I have had for transitioning, namely that it enabled me to stop thinking about it, to stop worrying about it, and to get past it and get on with life.
So one of the things you touched upon there is this idea that one becomes conscious of the fact that perhaps their gender role in terms of their social expression or in terms of their embodiment doesn't quite fit their self-understanding.
Yes.
This touches on this sort of philosophical issue about the mind and body relationship.
Yeah.
And it's something that, again, goes all the way back to Plato.
Yeah.
So is this a sort of privileging of the mind and one's own kind of mental self-conception over the body and seeing the body as a sort of prison, to go again back to Plato? Mm-hmm. How do you understand the way that?
Well, when it comes to the kind of dualism that you get in Descartes between mind and body, or the rather different kind of dualism that you get in Plato between psyche and soma, a lot of the time I find myself unsure what people really mean by this distinction, because there seem to me to be lots of cases where it's not at all clear that we have a neat distinction between the mind and the body. For example, our dispositions, our innate tendencies to do things, are they physical or are they mental? I'm not sure I know the answer. If I have a tendency to get angry, for example, when confronted with pictures of Donald Trump, there's certainly a mental element to that, but there's a physical element to it too. In the philosophy of mind, I think I'm more like what Aristotle calls a hylomorphist. I'm someone who thinks that the bodily and the mental are two aspects of the same reality, and they're not easily separated from each other at all. There are paradigm cases of things that look purely mental and that look purely physical, but I'm a bit skeptical about the idea of a clean disjunction between the two categories. So when it comes to the way that transgender people understand themselves, I'm not quite sure what to say. I think the urge to come to live in the gender in which you were not born, and in some cases to modify yourself physically so that you become someone who is just as if they had been born in that gender, in pretty well all ways, apart from things that you'd have to dig deep very scientifically to get at, such as chromosomes, you become someone who is in the gender that you were not born in. Now, the desire to do that, is that a desire for the mind to dominate the body? Is it just a mental thing? Well, no, plainly it isn't, because if it was just a mental thing, then people would not feel any need to change their bodies. And certainly from my own experience, it seems to come from the wish to present as female, the wish to be female. It seems to come from a very deep place, from the kind of place where the dispositions come from. And that's a place where it seems to me there isn't a neat disjunction to be made between the mind and the body. So I would very much resist the idea that this is just about mind or just about feelings, come to that.
To stay on the mind for a little bit, though, you said in an article that you wrote for the Institute on Ideas, you argue that consciousness is itself gendered. So the way we perceive the world, our subjectivity, is shaped by our gender, by whether one is male or female. Now, some people might say, well, they never really think about their gender as they navigate the world, or gender doesn't really enter in their consciousness. You yourself said that transitioning into the gender you felt more comfortable with allowed you to stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
So what would you say to people that say, well, you know, my consciousness doesn't seem to be gendered?
Well, I think I'd say a lot of the time, neither does mine. A lot of the time, I don't think about it. It doesn't matter. I'm doing philosophy, I'm reading some passage of Plato, or I'm scratching my head about the problem of equality in politics or something like that. And it simply doesn't matter whether I'm male or female for those purposes. But it's a bit like something that Wittgenstein says about the question of the meaning of life. It's a question that unhappy people ask. Mm. It's a question that shows a certain kind of discomfort with the situation you're in. If you're doing well, if things are going well, you don't feel the need to ask, well, what's the meaning of life? Because it's right there in front of you. It's there in everything you're doing. You're content. You don't have a sense that there's some meaning that you're missing out on. You just get on with things. And so I think when people say, I don't have any sense of my own gender, I think often what they mean is simply that they're free of the kind of ways in which gender can be a prison. Because when I say that our consciousness is gendered, I'm saying something which I think is politically very loaded and not always in good ways. I think our consciousness is both gendered and sexed. We get a sense of who we are from the kind of bodies that we have. And when you look more widely in the kingdom of nature, it should be obvious the kind of bodies we have radically affect the kind of experience that we have. Thomas Nagel's famous essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, exemplifies that. If you are a bat, then your awareness of the world is quite different from how it is if you're a human because of differences in your body. If you're a mantis shrimp, a creature I write about in my book Epiphanies, mantis shrimps have, by some measure, I think it's like 3 or 4 times more powerful and accurate vision than we do. And they use that accurate vision to be the most devastatingly good hunters under the sea. So a mantis shrimp's life is conditioned by their perceptual abilities and by the shape of their body. And so are humans. Now, you might think that because the differences between a male human body and a female human body are relatively small compared with those between us and mantis shrimp, you might think that it's not surprising that actually there's less of a sense of difference between male consciousness and female consciousness. And I think that's true. So that's all the physical side of the ways in which our consciousness is sexed. It's also gendered by the fact that we stand in a history within which men have been dominant and violence has been the way of exerting that dominance. And unfortunately, tragically, in many other countries and indeed in Britain itself, that's still how things go on. It's still violence which is the currency of oppression, either actually exercised violence or implied violence. So is consciousness gendered? Yes, it is. And that's a thing which can often be quite politically disturbing, uncomfortable, and indeed at times just plain evil. Are there ways for gender to be positively inflected? Can it be something that's a good thing to have? Yes, I think so. I think it's something that it's a role that you can live in. It's a role that you can be creative with. And I think most men and women, for example, in the way they play with fashions, do this. Mm. And people play with gender presentations deliberately in ways which I think can be constructive and good.
So does that mean that in the case of being transgender, one's consciousness is going to be quite different from a cisgendered man or a cisgendered woman, because perhaps there is a way in which one's consciousness is sex and a way one's consciousness is gendered? So can you say a little bit more about how being transgender shapes subjectivity in a way that might be unique?
Right, yes. I think that it does shape our subjectivity in all sorts of ways. But one thing I'd want to say about transgender people is that we're enormously various. Mm. There are trans men, there are trans women, there are people who are non-binary, there are people who are all sorts of different variations in the famous alphabet that some conservatives complain about so much. They seem to find it very difficult. There are lots of types of people. They don't mind there being lots of types of cars or lots of types of houses that you can live in, but that there should be lots of types of people seems to give them great offense. Anyway, I can only, the point I'm getting towards is that I can only speak for myself. For myself, I would say that I've been aware all along that, to use a perceptual metaphor, different bits of the landscape were lit up for me from other people. And I just had this different way of looking at the world from other people. And my attention would immediately go to things that other people wouldn't even notice. And I would want things that other people weren't remotely interested in. And in those kinds of ways, I became aware very early on that I was not like other people, that I was differently wired. And I think for transgender people, what it typically is a certain kind of awareness of how we can use our difference to shape a space in the world for ourselves, if we're allowed to, and if we get lucky, and if we're not, don't have it beaten out of us, which is not going to be quite the shape that either cis men or cis women inhabit. That's how it is for some trans people. We're finding a different space for ourselves. For other trans people, they're what's sometimes called submarines. They just want to go right into the identity of a cis man or a cis woman. They want to identify with that. There are trans people who say, I mean, there are transphobes who say, how dare you call me cis? I'm not a cis woman, I'm just a woman. There are also trans people who say, how dare you call me a trans woman? I'm not a trans woman, I'm just a woman. Some people just want to vanish from the landscape entirely. So eventually what I'm getting to is this thought that there's a great deal of diversity there within trans people. We're a rainbow, just trans people are a rainbow. Never mind the alphabet of identities that the Conservatives complain about.
Yeah, so given this spectrum of identities when it comes to transgender people, I'd like to ask you about John Stuart Mill. So he famously says, we cannot know what each gender is like in their natural state because we've only known gender through this distorting lens of societal norms and constructs. So this question seems to assume that there is an essence, as it were, to gender, right? There is a something it is to be a man and a woman in the natural state, over and above the ways that these things are expressed and developed in social context. But is that really true? Do you think there is an essence to male gender and female gender outside of social norms and social context?
In a word, yes. And the reason why I think that, well, perhaps I'm answering a different question, but I think the essence is sex. So I think biological sex is real. And this is the thing we're routinely accused of not thinking. And I think nothing of the sort. And it's enormously frustrating to have this false accusation constantly made. Insofar as there is an essence of what it is to be male or female, it goes with the biology. And only a few people deviate from the biological binary, which is the way things are in the human species. Other species are different. So insofar as there's an essence, it goes with the biology. And that's why it matters, I think, that consciousness is sexed as well as gender being sexed. So trans people find themselves in an uncomfortable position precisely because they have this, well, this trans relationship rather than the cis relationship, another side relationship rather than this side relationship to the facts of the body, which I in no way deny. But I think Mill is absolutely right to think that you can't find an essence of femininity if that means some social way of behaving that's divorced from the biology. No, that certainly doesn't exist. All you've got is the different ways in which, as it usually is, men have oppressed women through society. And that starts with Homer. So in some things I've written, I start with the amazing passage in Homer Book 1, where Chryseis, the young woman, is being returned by Agamemnon. In all this palaver and all this ritual and all this sacrificing of bulls, Chryseis herself doesn't say a word. Chryseis is returned to her father, and she is the currency in a transaction. She doesn't get to say a word. It's a wonderful passage of Homer, but what it illustrates is how long and how deep the oppression of women goes, not just in our society, but in the societies which we take as canonical in thinking about how we founded our own society.
But to go back to Mill for a second, I mean, the way I've previously read him is as saying that it's not really about sex, what he's talking about. It is the expression of gender. So we wouldn't know how women express their gender and how men express their gender in the sort of natural state, first man and first woman sort of situation. But is that accurate? Is it accurate to sort of use that as a regulative ideal of sorts, as it were, when we talk about gender in our society today?
Well, I'm not sure why one would want to find that originary state. It seems that Mill there is engaging in a kind of enlightenment project where, you know, for example, children were marooned on desert islands to see what language they came out with, mm-hmm. because the language that they came out with on the desert island would necessarily be the language of the Garden of Eden, and that's somehow privileged. This seems to me to be the wrong kind of scientific project of attempting to understand what it is to be human. And it seems to me we'd do much better to go another direction that Mill also points us towards with his wonderful phrase, experiments of living. What we should do is we should see what works. We should try various ways of living out, and we should see if we can make them work as good means, good ways for human beings to live together. And I think that's all in practice that people ever actually do. They don't find an originary state because there isn't an originary state. There's just a succession of societies going back to the time when the human species emerged in the first place. And none of that has any kind of privileged status. So we should look forward. We should think about where we can go from here, not about where we come from.
To combine this sort of pluralism that you're talking about in Mill with what you mentioned earlier about the long history of oppression of women by men, you've described gender ideology as oppressive. You mentioned that earlier as well, for both men and women.
Yeah.
So is that, I mean, in the case of women, I guess we have this long history where it's very direct. The oppression is very, it's not implicit, it's very explicit. What do you see the oppression of men as being? Is it that there is sort of one ideal of what it is to be a man and then everything gets judged on the basis of that? Why are men oppressed?
Well, men aren't oppressed anything like as much as women. But I think that men find themselves being put into boxes where certain kinds of expression are forbidden them. And I think that can be very hard for them. So the possibility of relationships of the kind of openness and helpfulness to each other that women often get in our society, that possibility is much harder for men to realize. And men, as soon as they try to engage in that kind of behavior, for example, putting an arm around someone else's shoulder, immediately there's a, ooh, back off, stop it, what are you, a puff, kind of response. And I think that kind of response, which is deeply ingrained in men and boys, is very oppressive of them. You know, as soon as they try becoming expressive, there's a roadblock right in front of them. And I think that's true even in our society, even today, which is very liberated. I think it's much more true in past societies. So that is the kind of thing that I would describe as the oppression of men. Is it on the same scale of women as the oppression of women? Of course not, nowhere near.
Given the sort of oppressive nature of gender, I mean, some feminists have argued for the complete abolition of it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a possibility? Do you think we would ever be able to erase gender completely from our
I'm open-minded lives? About it. I take seriously Mill's phrase about experiments of living. Let's try it and see what happens. And there certainly are people who do this experiment of living, who try living as completely ungendered, who use pronouns they, for example, who refuse to be caught in what they see as the gender binary precisely because it's oppressive. I'm very interested in the idea of just playing this out and seeing where it goes. Play the hand out, see what cards you've got. At the same time, I also think that there are ways for the gender stereotypes we have to be played with, subverted, used, repurposed, which might well be creative and good. And the third thing I think is that there's such a thing, people talk sometimes when they're climbing or doing music or doing other kinds of art, they talk about being in the flow. And when you're in the flow, you kind of, you're doing it, you're doing whatever it is, you're performing at your very best, but you're kind of not self-conscious about it. You don't have a strong sense that you're doing this thing. I think sometimes with gender, we're in the flow and we're doing what comes naturally and we barely notice that we're doing it. And I think that's a happy state to be in.
And to go back to something you talked about earlier, you said there are these sort of benign versions of gender expression, gender ideology. Is that found in these experiments, that creative ways of using it or subverting it?
Yes, I think that's right. I think these ways of using gender can be profoundly, helpful to the people who engage in them. I mean, here's one thing that trans people often do. They start out with a quite extreme phase in which they express themselves. If they're trans women, in particularly flamboyant and frilly ways, they go a long way down the path of trying to look like Julie Andrews or Doris Day. And as they get more relaxed about being trans, they don't feel the need to do that anymore. So Coming back to personal journeys, I think this is something that changes both for cis women and for trans women, and also for men, both cis and trans. As time goes on, you feel less need to be assertive about these things, to be emphatic about them, to take them to extremes that others may find a bit extreme, a bit strong. So I think it changes over time.
We said that our questions are not that different from those of ancient philosophers. Is there an ancient Greek philosopher you think would be most open to talking about the philosophy of gender identity and trans identity? Who would be best suited to write a treatise on this?
I think that that's a very difficult question to answer, and I'm not quite sure what to say. I think one character from Greek mythology who's very interesting in this respect is Tiresias, who, as you may know, had a weird encounter with a snake being a symbol of Apollo. And when he picked up the snake, he turned into a woman. And when he picked it up again, he turned back into a man. And so touching the snake seemed to be some kind of activity which got Tiresias to transition from one gender to the other. And one of the stories about Tiresias is, of course, that he was asked by the goddess Hera, I want to know whether sex is better for men or for women. Hmm. And so Tiresias gets to experience sex from both sides, and his report is it's far better for women. So this is a strange psychosexual myth with all kinds of obvious ways in which, for example, touching the snake could be reduced to something pretty basic and pretty obvious. But it's a really interesting myth. So I would be interested in the ways in which the Greeks play with the idea of gender and the ways in which, for example, there's a long poem by the Roman poet Statius about the myth that Achilles spent his childhood on the island of Scaros because his mother, Thetis, saw the Trojan War coming and wanted to hide Achilles from it. So she put him on Scaros, and he lived his youth as a woman, as a girl and a woman. I'm interested in that sort of myth and what's going on when the Greeks tell that kind of myth. So they're certainly playing with the idea of gender. But I think in both Aristotle and Plato, there's perhaps too much misogyny for things to be quite where we'd like them to be. Well, I mean, one of my favorite thinkers about gender in the ancient world is Sappho, but we have barely any of her works, unfortunately.
Sophie Grace Chappell, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.